With the electrical power demand growing exponentially in California, why has the state closed itself off from the largest source of carbon-free power generation in the United States? In other words, why is California holding on so tenaciously to its ban on new nuclear power plants? We're going to talk today to an expert researcher and author who answers these questions and more on today's episode of Independent Conversations. Hi, everybody. Graham Walker coming to you from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And welcome to today's discussion with Paige Lambermont, who is a policy fellow here at Independent and is also affiliated with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Welcome, Paige.
Thanks for having me, Graham.
It's great to have you. Your report is actually part of our ongoing series of California Golden Fleece Awards. That's our series where, with a kind of tongue-in-cheek satire, we put the spotlight on policies and policymakers that fleece taxpayers and make life here in California worse and more costly for everybody. So in that light, I'm also glad to be joined for today's discussion by the director of our Golden Fleece research program, Christian Fors. Welcome, Christian.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's jump in. Paige, how long has it been since a nuclear power plant was last built in California?
In California, it's been since the 80s. It's been a really long time.
And that's longer than other states, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the last nuclear power plant to come online in the United States was in Georgia in 2024.
And California is since 1980-something?
Yeah, it was Diablo Canyon was the last nuclear power plant built.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, I mean, there's a kind of maybe phobia or fear, you know, about nuclear energy everywhere, maybe especially in California. I remember when I was growing up down in Orange County, we would drive south down the Coast Highway. And when you get beyond Dana Point, then there's these two looming round things, which is San Onofre, a nuclear a generating station, and it also almost looked like it was Martians had landed or something. And I remember thinking, oh, I wonder what's going on inside those big round things right by the ocean. So people don't really know what nuclear energy is and how it works. Can you educate us briefly on that?
Yeah.
What is it?
In its most basic form, nuclear power, just like natural gas and coal power, is a really complicated way of boiling water. all of these power plants exist to turn steam turbines to generate electricity. Nuclear does it with fissile material. Natural gas plants burn natural gas. Coal plants burn coal. But it's all just trying to turn a turbine. Now, some of the new designs, new more complicated advanced reactors and things use molten salt and other materials rather than just water and have different processes. But, you know, your classic pressurized water reactor, it's there to boil water. Just a really complicated way of boiling water. And it provides about 20% of the United States' electricity. We have about 94 operational reactors across a bunch of sites in a bunch of different states in the U.S., most of which have been operating for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years. Not quite 70 yet, actually. The next phase of license renewals will take us to that point. They've been operating safely for a long, long time. The worst accident in U.S. history was Three Mile Island, which was essentially a slight release of some radioisotopes that resulted in no danger to any human life. So our track record in the United States for commercial nuclear power is really, really good.
Unlike in some other countries.
Yeah, I mean, mostly the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean, other Western countries actually do really well. The Russian Soviet system did not do very well.
No, and that was more a failure of communism than it was of nuclear power. In the first place, the RBMK reactors, the reactors used in the Soviet Union, were graphite core reactors that were much more unstable than our reactors are. And then when you put Soviet bureaucracy on top of that, at Chernobyl, what was happening was basically a middle of the night test of the reactor to intentionally push it past its breaking point, kind of to see what would happen, to see what it could take. And they found out what it could take, and it wasn't very good. You take it past its breaking point, and it's going to break. And in any Western nation, any free market, free nation, you would have seen an immediate announcement that something had gone wrong. You would have seen, immediate crisis response. And instead, you saw dithering and hiding and pretending that this wasn't happening and lying to the rest of the world about it. And so both the cause of the accident and the outcomes afterwards were much worse because of where it was happening and how that place was governed.
Christian and I were talking yesterday, trying to figure out why it is people are so afraid of nuclear energy. And I suppose it's because of Chernobyl, huh?
I think it's a combination of because of Chernobyl and the like the mental impact that that had for people, and also the nature of radiation. You can't see radiation. You can't feel radiation as it happens to you. It can only be detected like, you know, by Geiger counters and things. And because you can't see, feel, touch, taste that this thing is happening, it's very scary. And I think more so scary than things that you can tell are about to happen. It's kind of got this quiet doom to it. And because of the nature of messaging within the nuclear industry over the years, it was a very sort of no press is good press sort of idea. And because of that, people only ever heard about things when they went wrong. You know, you only hear about the bad things. You don't hear about the good things. You don't hear about consistent, reliable power, all of these other things. Or you don't hear the good safety record. You only notice when things go awry. And I think because of that, you know, approach to public relations, things weren't going so well in terms of public perception. Now, I think about, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, that way of communicating with the public really changed. You know, you got places like the Nuclear Energy Institute talking about how this technology works and what it does and how safe it is and how reliable it is. And I think that messaging has really worked because we've seen in the polls nuclear just tick up in popularity as people understand it better and hear about it more.
One of the things that I remember you mentioned in your report was the fact that Germany is phasing out most of its nuclear energy. So my question is, I know that Europe is really trying to be energy self-reliant because of the war with Russia and Ukraine. If they're trying to attain energy self-reliance, why on earth would they close their nuclear power plants?
This is one of my favorite issues to talk about because it is one of the most ridiculous stories you'll ever tell. I mean, when you work on policy issues like this, you're constantly trying to tell your friends and family about them. And usually they're like, oh, yeah, OK, that makes sense. Your argument's good. On this one, every time I tell someone the story, they go, but why would they do that? But why? I don't understand why. And I go, I don't understand why either. So basically, Germany had 17 nuclear reactors in their country at the time of Fukushima. So in 2011. And when Fukushima occurred in 2011, of course, it was a nuclear accident prompted by a massive earthquake and tsunami. I don't know if you are familiar with the geography of Germany. Not a lot of earthquake and tsunami risk going on in Germany. But, you know, following that accident, which was itself pretty well handled in the aftermath, no deaths were directly attributed to Fukushima. There were deaths, tons of deaths from the earthquake and the resulting evacuations because of Fukushima, but none from the actual radiation harms. But following Fukushima, the German government got very frightened by radiation risk. And so they shut down all 17 nuclear reactors temporarily, and they ran two concurrent sort of assessments of the situation. They had an ethics commission and a reactor safety commission. The reactor safety commission found that nothing like Fukushima could happen in Germany. There was no likelihood of an earthquake tsunami-based disaster at German nuclear plants, obviously, because there's no real earthquake and tsunami risk in Germany. But the ethics commission found that although the real risks from nuclear power had not changed in the country, the perceived risks had. And then they began the process of Energiewende, or the German nuclear phase out, the energy transition. And this policy would, over the following, you know, 13 years, close all 17 nuclear reactors. And that culminated in the closure of their final three nuclear reactors, closed in April of 2023.
So that means there are no German plants currently operating?
There are no operating German nuclear reactors. But I don't know if you guys know what was going on in 2022 and 2023. Germany had lost almost all of its natural gas supplies. They had just at the beginning of the Ukraine war closed three more nuclear power plants. And then they had three left. They were supposed to close in December of 2022. And they got it together enough to keep them open the rest of that winter so that no one froze. But they really did. They went, we need to keep these nuclear reactors open. There's not, like, we don't have Russian gas right now. We don't know what the future holds. We can't close these nuclear reactors. But so instead of keeping them open, like indefinitely or for until the war ended or any reason, they managed to push it till April. And then in April, they were duly closed. But there was really no rhyme or reason behind this. German nuclear plants were some of the best engineered in the world. They were highly reliable, highly safe.
Yeah, I was thinking like
nothing wrong with them.
When you want to buy like a really highly engineered car, you know, this whole precision, you buy a German car.
Yeah.
The Germans are famous for their precise technology. So they probably had the safest in the world.
They had really great nuclear power plants. There was nothing wrong with these nuclear power plants. It was not a safety issue. It was not anything. And it wasn't, they didn't have reliability complaints about these plants. These plants were running near round the clock, near 365. You know, they closed for their 2 or 3 days every 18 months to refuel, and that's about it. You can pretty much trust a nuclear power plant like clockwork. So there was no reliability risk from these plants. There was no safety risk from these plants. But Germany has a really intense culture of being anti-nuclear and of perceiving sort of the radiation risk. And it's part of the whole green movement that there's just a significant cultural distaste for and pushback against nuclear power in the country. That has shifted a bit post-nuclear phase out because it didn't go great for them. I mean, they're importing a lot more power from nuclear France. They are, you know, closing a lot of industrial capacity. I mean, I'm sure you've seen headlines lately, like Germany loses its industrial crown. Like I've seen that headline lots of, it's because they were major industrial producers of lots and lots of products for a long, long time. There's a reason that German engineering is touted as it is. And an energy poor society cannot be a engineering exporting society. That just doesn't work. And so I think they're really kind of running up against the consequences of this decision, especially because they're trying to phase out gas and coal too. You can kind of choose one of the three to get rid of. Maybe it's not even a good idea to do that, but you can't go for all three. Like it just doesn't work to get rid of all of your reliable thermal power plants at once. And Germany even made the choice to start bringing back coal so they could phase out nuclear faster. Their Green Party at a certain point was reopening coal mines in small towns so that they could open coal plants and close their nuclear plants.
So they'd rather coal pollution in the air than any kind of risk of radiation.
Yeah, they were so afraid of the nuclear that they went back to coal. And I mean, coal's highly reliable power, nothing against coal here. But if you're the Green Party, who's advocated for the closure of coal plants for how God knows how long, to then go around and say, but we should, you know, we should reopen the coal plants to close the nuclear plants faster, it's just kind of an illogical policy, especially at a time when you're short on gas.
The comparison with France is interesting to me. France has been all in on nuclear energy for a long time.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to have the same degree of ideological anti-nuclear as Germany has. And they export power to Germany, which is reminding me of California, because California won't open new nuclear plants, but we import electricity from other places and other states.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. So France is a really interesting example on this because they've done a really good thing in a really silly way, as far as I'm concerned. Like they've gone to majority nuclear. They've, you know, used the same plant design over and over and over again in a way that's led to lots of economies of scale. That's all been great. But they've done it by allowing their federal government to control the entirety of their energy sector. And they've also done it in a way where Macron had to roll back a policy that would have required them to go to only a much lower percentage of nuclear in order to meet like wind and solar renewable goals. But when you don't count, when you want carbon-free energy and you don't count nuclear power as carbon-free energy, you get problems. And you get the logical like policies that say, I know your grid is 96% nuclear power, but you really need to put more wind and solar on it. And of course, they eventually realized that policy was insane and went away from it. But they were planning for several years to, you know, phase out a few of their nuclear power plants to replace them with wind, solar and other, you know, things that qualified for this renewable standard. So like France, although it has done much better than its neighbors, has not been perfect on these issues at all. And even they were considering moving away from some of their nuclear for a while. But, you know, just that the government-based nature of how they've gone about it, I don't think has been ideal. But I do think that they've gotten some pretty impressive results compared to a lot of other countries.
Christian, you had some questions about the California angle. I thought I meant to make sure you get to have a chance to ask them.
Yes, no problem. So the biggest question is, why is nuclear energy prohibited in California? What is this moratorium? Why did it come about? Why does California, one of the largest economies in the entire world, not allow such a powerful technology within its borders?
Yeah, so nuclear energy is banned in California under an amendment to the Warren Allquist's Act that basically established the California Energy Commission and also said that no nuclear power could occur at any site besides Diablo Canyon and San Andre, which were already existing at the time. And so since then, since I think it was 1984, no new nuclear power in the state. And it's been a really, I think, interesting and silly state to have chosen to do that in, because especially as power demand grows right now from the tech industry. The tech industry is mostly located in Silicon Valley in California. And so a lot of these companies that are designing new advanced nuclear reactors, a lot of the companies that are demanding new power are headquartered in California, but can't, you know, can't make the deals that they're making other places in California. And so it's really, this policy has hamstrung the ability of existing industries in the state to prosper or to prosper there. They're prospering. They're just doing it elsewhere. And so I think it makes it profoundly silly, especially when you wonder, like, you know, what's the economic impact of this policy? Like, would anyone actually care to build a nuclear power plant in California if we didn't have this policy in place? And I think that maybe 5 years ago, you could have made the argument that no one's trying to. But now when Google and Meta and Amazon and every company that's headquartered in California, or some of them were until the tax rate became too much of a problem and they had to move somewhere else, which is, you know, its own issue. When these companies that are based there are signing, you know, multi-billion dollar contracts with nuclear companies, I think it's really clear that the demand is there. Like, someone wants to use this technology and pay for this technology. But if they're not allowed to do it in California, they'll do it somewhere else.
Absolutely. And something I was going to say is that, like Germany, California has also prioritized green energy sources. And if I understand correctly from your report, nuclear is actually one of the most sustainable energy sources. It has the lowest, I believe, per unit of energy. Does it not have the lowest land use requirements?
Yeah, it's one of the lowest. I think it's similar to maybe it's wind, but there's like maybe one other that's competitive with it, but it's the most minimal land use requirements. I'm sorry. Land use requirements is the lowest. I was thinking about its carbon intensity. It's similar to wind and solar on carbon intensity, but on land use, it is by far the lowest. It's lower than even natural gas, which is the next highest. But it is, I mean, next lowest. It is infinitely easier in terms of land use to build and site a nuclear power plant in a small amount of space than it is to do anything else. And that's for traditional large reactors. For small modular reactors and other advanced reactor designs, that's going to be an even smaller amount of space.
Even less, yeah.
The land you need isn't even determined by the nuclear reactor itself. It's by the planning zones that are required for it. So when the small modular and advanced reactors require smaller planning zones, it will innately require less space.
So you can contrast that, for example, with these places where you see these solar panel arrays, massive acreage covered with these things that are full of dangerous chemical ingredients, and they're just covering over huge parts of California, huge parts of other states too. The amount of land covered by solar panels is vast compared to the tiny amount taken by nuclear.
Yeah, it's such a difference. And the idea that to be an environmentalist in California means preferring wind and solar to nuclear and hydro is insane to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, nuclear and hydro are both, as far as the carbon-free sources of electricity go, they are by far and away the reliable ones. So to prefer wind and solar to the large hydro and the nuclear is insane. When you're even looking at like the California renewable mandates and how far they have qualified for them, more than like what they'll do is they'll say, oh, we have 11% of this and we have 12% of nuclear and hydro that we refuse to actually talk about or pretend are real. You know, they won't consider the reliable nuclear and hydro as part of this. But they will count other less reliable things. So it's very silly.
Another contrast comes to mind is with wind power. So there are places just to the east of the San Francisco Bay Area that are similarly covered with these huge, monstrous, space alien looking things constantly spinning around and killing flying birds. acres and acres covered with these windmills compared to a tiny amount of land taken for nuclear.
Yeah, I actually, especially in a state like California, think that the wind is much more kind of concerning as part of the grid than the solar is, because at least California is very, very sunny. So at least the solar is intermittent in a predictable way. You know which hours of the day roughly it's going to be available for. The wind is just unpredictable. And so you really can't plan around it. You can't, you know, amp your batteries and natural gas up and down at the edges of that peak and valley. With the wind, you're just kind of guessing in the dark and trying to keep the grid balanced. So I think it has even more of a grid harm than the solar can have sometimes, in some cases.
Speaking of California's grid, could you just explain what exactly a grid is, how it works, why certain energy types are more or less suited for the grid?
Yeah, so the power grid in the United States is made up of the Eastern Interconnection, the Western Interconnection, and Texas. Texas is kind of its own thing. But the way that power grids are arranged within these interconnections is that some are vertically integrated utilities. That's what we had historically had. And in the vertically integrated utilities, the utility basically owns transmission, generation, distribution. They own the whole chain. They kind of manage it. The Public Utilities Commission oversees them, but they sort of are in charge of the whole stack. Now, in states like California and lots of other places, they have what's called a regional transmission organization. And California's is CAISO. But these organizations basically manage the power on the grid while the other elements are still owned in other ways. And so what they basically do is run auctions for power, where you bid in. If you're a power generator, you bid in at your cost of generation. They take the highest, they take the lowest cost bids in descending order and then pay everyone whatever the highest bid they took was. So, you know, if wind and solar bid in at like a few cents a megawatt hour, and then gas bids in a little higher and nuclear bids in a little higher than that, and they had to take it all, they'll pay the price that they paid the highest bidder. But it ends up being a very sort of distributed system by nature. So no one is entirely responsible for making sure that wise and prudent additions to the grid in terms of reliability are made. Like the buck doesn't really stop with anyone for that. And so, although the wholesale market does allow for some degree of, you know, a market function to occur, there have been enough, whether it be subsidies or other rules and regulations that have impacted that to a degree, that it doesn't necessarily function like a perfect market. And it also creates kind of other problems in terms of no one being essentially responsible for reliability in the area. So there's pros and cons about the vertically integrateds and the RTOs. They both have their problems. We might need to find a secret third thing at some point. But that's kind of how it works.
In terms of California's electricity supply, so the fact that we're in a grid means that we can import electricity from out of state when our own generation is not enough.
Right. So CAISO manages like most of California's electricity, and it's RTO that does the auction thing. But when there's not enough capacity there, you import from your neighbors.
More nuclear than California does.
Yes, yes, yes. There is definitely some degree of nuclear import happening in California, despite your own ban on nuclear power.
So we're better off. We're less vulnerable than we would be, since we can rely on other states to do some nuclear power.
Yeah, well, California, I think just by the nature of its energy policy, will be a net power importer. Actually, it's the second highest power importer in the country besides Virginia. Wow. And Virginia, until like a few years ago when data centers were being built other places, the internet was physically located in Northern Virginia until, you know, a few years ago. Now, most of it still is, but it's branching out. But Virginia's was a lot of data center demand. California's is a lot of, we can't really handle our own power grid kind of imports going on. And a lot of it's a choice, right? I mean, it's very hard to build new natural gas in California. It's illegal to build new nuclear in California. The constant goal is to close the existing hydro. There's just really no interest in continuing to have reliable power.
It seems to me that the California public or the voters are kind of captive to sort of an ideological fixation about what it means to be pro-environment. They have this idea that anything generated by human activity is a threat to the environment, and therefore they're against any expansion energy generation?
I think part of that comes just from the degrowth concept in general, the idea that we should all be making do with less, using less, having less, contributing less, producing less, and developing less. And when you have that ideology, you know, why do we need more and better power plants? We shouldn't be doing as much. And that's great if you don't want to have the quality of life that Americans are generally accustomed to.
Well, Californians complain everything's too expensive, but that's because we don't produce enough housing, et cetera.
We sure don't need to keep producing more power if you don't want to continue having heat, electricity, appliances that function, the ability to, you know, like, do any of the useful work or things that you like to do. Like, if you want to have a much lower quality of life that doesn't involve technology and anything that uses power, that's okay, I guess, but you can't be subjecting the rest of the United States to that. Like, other people don't necessarily want to live that way, and I don't think it's fair for a small group of people to decide that we should have and do less, especially when you look at charts. There are no low-energy rich countries. No country that doesn't produce very much energy per capita is also wealthy. It's impossible. Energy is a proxy for the ability to do work. And it does work that human beings would otherwise have to do. Turning on your heater is a task that would otherwise be you building a fire. Running your washing machine would otherwise be you down by the river. And I think even AI is doing thinking work that human beings would otherwise be doing. But so every single thing that we replace human labor with is basically electricity and energy in general, taking away from the needs of human labor so that people can do more and interesting things with their time instead of toiling. It replaces toil.
I would argue that California actually has a much more pro-energy history than you would think right now. I mean, this was a state of fantastic creativity, progress, burgeoning wealth, burgeoning middle class, all up through, at least the 60s and 70s. And even now, and I think a lot of Californians are sort of becoming more and more skeptical about this hostility toward energy generation, because they really don't want to give up their iPhones and everything else that comes with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think California is a really complicated state, right? Because it both draws in some of the most creative, thoughtful, and innovative people ever born, and also draws in people who want to protest against the very things that they would like to be able to consume.
Right, right.
Like, no one who is protesting gasoline, it doesn't drive a car. Like, it's not like, you know, you want to say things that are bad or evil or whatever, but at the end of the day, people do need these things to be able to actually thrive, and no one is really willing to actually voluntarily give up their own access to electricity. You just want to say that the power should be produced in some other way, in some other place, not near you, not in your backyard. And that's great and all, but it's got to be done somewhere.
Speaking of Californians and their proclivity to protest and have not in my backyard mentalities, I can imagine that there's a bunch of people in California who are semi-risk averse and say, oh, well, we already get some nuclear energy from Arizona or Washington. Why do we need a nuclear power generator here? What would you say to those people?
Nuclear power historically is one of the safest forms of power. In terms of like deaths that have occurred per type of power, it's the fewest. Building wind and solar facilities has historically been more dangerous than even continuing to operate nuclear power plants. They're not more dangerous than other things. I think that the image of Chernobyl is burned into people's minds, but an American nuclear reactor is not of the same. Even a 50-year-old American nuclear reactor is not as dangerous. And when we talk about like the Westinghouse AP1000s that were just built in Georgia, those are even safer. They're considered generation 3+ reactors. Generation 4 is the new advanced and small modular reactors, but generation 3+ reactors are passively safe. And the newer reactors that are being designed have incredible safety measures that make it almost impossible for something to happen. If the reactors were to go critical, they have passive safety measures that basically get the fuel out of the system and make it so that a meltdown could not occur. And so we're just talking about a fundamentally different thing than a Soviet RBMK reactor.
And are there any specific benefits to having a nuclear reactor be local rather than importing that same energy from elsewhere?
Oh, of course. So transmission in terms of the energy you get is incredibly costly. Like, you lose so much energy by transmitting it. The closer to the production you can possibly be, the better. I mean, there's a reason that a lot of data centers are trying to co-locate with power plants right now. And it is because, like, every mile that you are from that facility is going to lose some power. The closer you are, the better. And so, yeah, importing it from states away is wildly costly.
One thing I learned from your report, Paige, is that in California, specifically, the Warren-Ahlquist Act was the basis for these regulations, and it was amended in 1976, specifically in a very tricky way. At least it seemed tricky to me, namely that it forbids new nuclear power plants in California unless and until there's a solution to high-level nuclear waste storage, and that solution has to be approved by the federal government and then approved by California legislature, so that they're technically hanging the entire ban on the question of waste storage safety. Is that right?
It is, and a lot of the bans are that way, and I think it's a real sort of runaround, and it's based on the fact that the public doesn't know how nuclear waste works.
Yeah, that's what we want to learn from you, because I can imagine in, 40, 50 years ago, having this icky radioactive waste sitting around emitting radiation was a scary thought. But now...
So I think people picture from The Simpsons, like green barrels of glowing sludge
sitting
next to a nuclear power plant. It's all contained in dry casks, like cement and steel, that it's incredibly insulated and incredibly safe. It's more of a Yucca Mountain or another like geological repository is a safe for tens of thousands of years solution. The storage at sites across the country is a safe for hundreds of years solution. I mean, they're like a relative difference in that level of safety, but safe for hundreds of years is much safer than we require almost anything else to be. And it's the technology, our ability to reprocess fuel to come up with a safer solution to do anything over that period of time is only going to increase. But I think that where they're currently stored is perfectly safe. Of course, various sites don't want to continue storing. Everyone wants to centralize all of these things. And I think that it's all fine and good to want a permanent geological repository, especially because nuclear plants across the country have been paying into the trust fund to do that for a long, long time. So the money has already been set aside and exists. So I think once we get a geological repository, that'll be even better.
Well, but people in Nevada don't want it, right?
Yeah, I mean, but whether it's Yucca Mountain or somewhere else, right? Like, we don't necessarily have to build it there if it can't be arranged politically. But there are plenty of places it could happen. And I think that once we have that, that might answer some of these fights for once and for all. But I don't think necessarily it's reasonable to be scared of how it is currently stored, because I think it's already pretty safe. And I mean, we are technologically capable of spent fuel reprocessing. France does tons of spent fuel reprocessing.
This is sort of like recycling, right? You get the fuel that's been used and then you reprocess it and you use it again, or you reuse what's left of it. Is that right?
Yeah, basically. So most of what comes out of the spent fuel that comes out of a nuclear power plant is mostly reprocessable. About 95% of it is reprocessable uranium, 1-ish% is reprocessable plutonium, and the other 4% is stuff that you're just going to have to store. But that's almost all of it that can be reprocessed into new fuel. And I mean, that new process will then result in its own 4%, but if you get 4% out every time instead of 100% every time, it's a lot less waste. It's what France does. Their Orano facility actually reprocesses all of the spent fuel in France and a lot of spent fuel for other countries that import it and then take their waste back, basically. But they do a really good job of that. And it's something that we've got the technological capability to do. At one point, there were about 3 operating breeder reactors in the country, like under the Carter administration. And then the government kind of went the other way on that and was no longer really interested in doing so. And we don't really have any big scale for the commercial industry anymore happening.
So the only way California could break out of this obstacle would be if the legislature went back to that 1976 amendment and rescinded it or changed it. Is that right?
Exactly. And I think I actually said it was in 1984 earlier for some reason. I don't know why I slipped up and said that. Yeah. I don't know what made me think 1984 for a second. I remembered it. I was like, why did I say that? Yeah. So the way that they would have to resolve this basically is by going back and getting rid of that amendment. Now, the problem is, given the current composition of the California legislature, I don't know how likely that is. I don't know how much interest there is in doing that in a way that doesn't endanger other technologies, right? Like, there was a bill recently that would have allowed some small modular reactors, but would have made gas plants illegal in the state. I don't know if that's really a step forward. You're sort of helping one thing to hurt another that you both need both of for reliability. But I don't know if there's much interest in doing a just, hey, what if we were allowed to build all types of nuclear reactors again and also didn't make some other terrible trade-off to do it? I don't know what the interest level in doing that is, but I think given especially AI power demand, like AI power demand is really the thing that makes now the time for this. Because the thing is, 5, 10 years ago, no one was desperate to build a new nuclear power plant. Like it was just not, people do it every once in a while, but it wasn't like this big thing that is happening. And now it is very much a big thing that is happening. And the power demand is there for it to make sense. And it makes the money work because nuclear power is pretty expensive to build up front cost-wise. It is. It's very reliable and it lasts longer than almost anything. But it's hard to build up front and it's hard to get that much money together ahead of time. But when companies are going, I need 5 gigawatts by 2 years from now, all of a sudden the math works. And so I think that's the big difference here is that there are people who really want to build this stuff now and really want to build it in California. I mean, a lot of these companies are based in California and would presumably be building things there if they were allowed to. They're just going elsewhere because that's where they're allowed to do it.
Christian, you are a longtime native Californian. What do you think about this thought that Paige has just floated, that the moment might be opportune for a change in public attitude because of the growth of hypertech electricity usage? Is there any reason for optimism, do you think, politically there, Christian?
I would absolutely hope so because of the importance of AI and the importance of data centers. That being said, even if something is important, it can be difficult to convince the average person of its importance. And there's a lot of resistance in California for a lot of things, especially the housing shortage. I mean, you would just think that looking at the rents here, looking at the property values, that there would be an immense outcry to build, build, build. But unfortunately, that hasn't been the case. So while I would like to be optimistic for Californians' energy perspectives, unfortunately, history has made me a little bit more pessimistic.
A pessimistic Californian. But still, Christian, I'm just thinking people start feeling it themselves, on housing. There needs to be a elimination of all the restrictions that cause housing to be so costly and difficult to build here, because people are going to get fed up. And maybe similarly, people are going to get fed up with the high cost of energy and the inability to grow enterprises in California. And maybe I'm trying to be more optimistic than you.
I think the biggest problem with this is that it just relies on people's perceptions. So one of the most common misconceptions about housing, there are a lot of people that believe that building new housing actually increases the prices of current housing, because they believe in gentrification or these sort of convoluted theories about the nature of housing prices. So I'm sure there's a lot of people that have complete misconceptions about nuclear energy, and because of that, they're going to resist it when they don't realize it would actually benefit them in the long run.
Toward the end of your report, Paige, you have a series of recommendations. This is one of the best parts of your report. I mean, these reports are great generally because here at Independent Institute, we don't just complain, we actually point to solutions. And you do that here. You've got like 5 or 6 recommendations. Could you talk about maybe at least a couple of those that you think are especially important?
Well, I think like at the state level in California, getting rid of CEQA is the thing, right? Like
We call it CEQA here for short.
CEQA. Ah, okay. You never remember how to pronounce all the acronyms. There's too many acronyms in this world. But yeah, getting rid of your state-based NEPA, I think is huge. The
Oh,
fact that
state-based
regular
what? State-based what?
state-based NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act,
Okay, got
you
it.
know,
And then CEQA
CEQA
is the California Environmental Quality Act.
Got it, got it. Okay.
And so it basically takes the NEPA process and then does its own even more complicated and worse version again. So you get the punishment of NEPA, which everyone loves and is super fun. And then once you've completed that process, you get to do it again in a California. Different font. Yeah. And so basically, it's just this other layer of bureaucracy and time and expense that anyone who wants to build energy, or really anything. In the state. Yeah, anything. Yeah. But I mean, I mostly pay attention to how much it costs to build energy. But it takes time and money and manpower. And it means that some energy projects that otherwise would have been built just aren't, because they're too expensive and they're too hard. And okay, I'm going to go build it in Utah instead. It's easier.
And people can file an objection under CEQA to any kind of proposed construction of any kind, including energy, for any reason at any time.
And they do.
And they can do so anonymously.
Anonymously. Yeah, it's like there's two words in California that are like a magic spell, which is environmental impact. You just say those two words and you can add a decade to the any process of construction.
Exactly. And that, you know, that's happening on so many projects in the state. There are also crazy siting restrictions for new oil and gas development that I bet if nuclear were to be legalized would apply to nuclear too, or some similar version would be applied, you know, like whether that would be applied or whether they would say, you know, in the mold of this wonderful policy, we should also do this for nuclear and create their own strict thing.
And Paige, what exactly do you mean by a siting policy? What is that for the audience?
So like wherever new oil and gas development would be sited, like located, the siting is the location of the thing. There's a requirement that it be 3,000 feet from pretty much anything. I think it's any residence, any business, any school, any anything. And you think when you put it in feet, it seems short. 3,000 feet's almost 2 miles. It's not, you know, right next to your house. We're talking miles, and miles from anything. Now, so I live in Western Pennsylvania, and there is a natural gas well 500 feet that way. And there's a natural gas well 500 feet that way. And there's a natural gas well 500 feet that way. and it's fine. You know, you don't need to be 3,000 feet from any oil and gas development. Like, I mean, you don't want to be that close to like a massive offshore oil rig. But that's going to be offshore anyway. When we're talking about like gas and oil wells, a lot of the time they're very, very small and you barely can notice them. I mean, all of these wells that I know about from living here for a long time, I can't see from my house. I can't hear them. I can't tell that they're there. And so strict restrictions like that just make it very, very hard and very, very expensive to locate anything anywhere. And when you have policies like that, you're just less likely to get energy in the future.
So Paige Lamberman recommends that California lift its ban on new nuclear power plants. She recommends that CEQA be eliminated or modified. She recommends that there be an easing up on the site requirements. Those seem like pretty important recommendations. Do you want to highlight any other one?
I have some federal level recommendations. I don't know if we want to totally
sure.
get into those. But
just briefly.
I mean, we need across the board technology neutral broad-based permitting reform. Not just NEPA, but the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. We need to fix the repetitive processes that result in intense permitting processes followed by crazy sue and settle provisions where you're constantly just being sued out of existence for years after you've tried to build a project. None of that works, and we can't keep doing it in California or anywhere else in the country. Like real permitting reform just has to happen for a lot of this to work. And I think that's one of the big ones.
So federal change, too.
Yes. And also change to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Under the ADVANCE Act in 2024, some progress was made towards trying to make the NRC more friendly to just encouraging the industry to continue to exist. But it's really just not gone far enough. And like, it's a sclerotic agency that doesn't really want, I don't think, new nuclear power to continue to come into existence. Since the NRC has been around, only a few new nuclear power plants have been built. It came into existence in 1974, and there has been very little nuclear power development ever since.
Wow.
So I think that we just need to rethink the way that nuclear power is regulated in the country in general, especially at the NRC. And there's some other things like specific radiation risk requirements, ALARA and the linear no threshold measurement system are both, I think, things that need to be reviewed. They're just about sort of the amount of radiation exposure that is considered safe. Linear no threshold considers all radiation exposure to be unsafe. And if you don't know, bananas have radiation. Your cell phone is emitting radiate. Everything around you right now is emitting tiny amounts of radiation. So for nuclear power plant operators to have to commit to no radiation of any kind is an impossible standard, given that,
that is kind
pretty
of
much
amazing.
Everything produces radiation. And so you can't, like, fully minimizing it. You want to minimize it below, like, far below safe thresholds. But you can't minimize it to zero because it's just, it's ambient at this point.
So we need to come in for a landing here. Before we do, Christian, any final issue or question that you'd like to pose to Paige Lambermont?
No, I believe that's everything. It's just, I think this is an incredibly important subject. I think it's incredibly important for the future of California, for the future of the nation. And if I remember correctly, there was a transcription above Chernobyl that says the atom is to be used as a friend, not as a soldier, not to be weaponized. Mm-hmm. So it is my sincere hope that the United States and our energy companies can use the atom as a friend and power abundance.
Yeah, power abundance. I think that, you know, if California specifically and U.S. policy more generally were to adopt, oh, even half of the recommendations that Paige Lambermont has made here, we could actually usher in an era of dramatic abundance in energy, which could really improve American life and California in particular.
Yeah, I mean, all rich societies are energy-dense societies.
Mm-hmm.
And creating a situation in which you can produce more energy than you need is how you get to be able to do more cool things. And I think California, being the place where Silicon Valley is it could be such a source for new development of ideas and things. And has really hamstrung its own ability to do so with its energy policy.
Yes, absolutely. Let's make sure that your voice gets heard on this point, especially here in California. Your report is titled Ensuring Power Reliability in California, Why the Nuclear Ban Must Go. It's in the Independent Institute's series of California Golden Fleece research reports. I invite our friends who've joined us for this conversation to head to our website, independent.org, where you will be able to find this report by Paige Lambermont and a lot of other interesting things that bear on these questions. Thank you so much, Paige, for joining us. It's much appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
And Christian Forrest, thanks for your help.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And come back next time to Independent Conversations. Take care, everybody.